Oborne and Heller on Cricket, brought to you by the Chiswick Calendar.
Hello, it's Peter Oborne here, back in business in sunny Wiltshire.
Hello, it's Richard Heller, and it's also great to be back in business, and it's also sunny in southeast London.
I'm very glad to hear that, Richard. Now, we've got two guests who've written, I think, the most immense and wonderful and glorious book. It's a sort of book which fills me with envy. I feel that you and I ought to have written it, not these two imposters. Actually, it's completely lovely. Introduce our wonderful guests.
Well, it is a great pleasure to welcome Timothy Abraham and James Coyne to the podcast. They are co-editors of one of our favourite sections of Wisden, Cricket Round the World, and they have drawn on that to write this absolutely astonishing book called Evita Burned Down My Pavilion, which is just one of the astonishing episodes in a book subtitled, rightly, A Cricket Odyssey Through Latin America. It's a book which, as you say, I wish we'd been able to write. There are a few continents left to us, but certainly not Latin America after this one. It gives the history and the present state of cricket in every country in the American continent, from Mexico to Chile, with the sole exception of Guyana, which is, of course, part of West Indian cricket. James and Timothy, I know you've had great sort of experience in advance of cricket in Latin America through editing Cricket Round the World in Wisden. But James, what made you decide to write this book, and how long did it take you to complete The Odyssey, which actually includes Tierra del Fuego, right in the south of the continent?
Well, I mean, I think, as any journalist will know, there's always a sense in the back of your mind that unless you do something, someone else will. And as you sort of referred to it in the intro, really. And we thought this was our chance to do a book like this. You know, we're at the stage of our lives when we could do it. We sort of both quit our jobs and went ahead and did it and just went for it. We thought, why not? You know, we were sort of in our early to mid 30s. It was, you know, in terms of staying in hostels and slumming it, and it was the time when we could just about put up with that. And we thought, this is the chance to do it. I mean, a guy called Angus Bell wrote a great book, Batting on the Bosphorus, which was going around Eastern Europe, and that inspired us to a degree. But we had no idea before we really put the research in that there was such a footprint of cricket in Latin America. And I think that's what really encouraged us to do it, that there was this amazing historical footprint. And also it was still played pretty much everywhere. So that encouraged us that it wasn't just going to be a booze fest staying in hostels. It was also going to be something which would hopefully go down as an important book if we could do it right.
Now, I can't say how important I think it is. It tells us so much about British diplomacy, about British business, about Latin America itself. Who knew that Maradona played a bit of cricket? I mean, it's just every page has got a new piece, new detail, which absolutely opens your eyes and brings it alive. It does remind Richard and I, we travelled around Pakistan together, and it just, writing our books, and it was so much like that experience you have. It's a way of telling a history of a continent through one prism, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd agree with that, absolutely. That was part of it for James and I. We were both, I went backpacking around South America in the early 2000s, and very much fell in love with the continent then. So I had a kind of a personal affinity to want to go back there. And obviously, as I got more involved in writing about cricket for Wisden, I started to realise there was, particularly with these tales we got for Cricket Around the World, that there was often a lot more we could have written or said about many of those entries. But Lawrence Booth and Hugh Chevalier and others, you know, are condensing us to a set amount. So James and I could have written, you know, or correspondents could have filed a lot more words than we actually got in Cricket Around the World. So this book was a real opportunity to really get under the skin of some subjects and some interesting histories and fantastic stories, many of which I think, particularly for James and I, appeal because we love telling stories that nobody has ever told before. We love unearthing information from history which has been lost for hundreds of, you know, in hundreds of years, even in some instances. So I think that was part of what kind of really inspired us. Again, like James said, Harry Thompson's book, Penguin Stop Play, that was a kind of source of inspiration as well. I remember reading that when I was 18, 19, and it was a book that really, really kind of struck a chord with me and fostered my interest in cricket in strange and unusual places.
Mm. You must have had some preparation for what you were going to see, but were you nonetheless amazed to see how much cricket there actually is in Latin America? Because I certainly was as a reader.
Well, I mean, one thing I would say is that the one thing that the British have been good at over the years has been writing things down and recording things. And there was a staggering backlog of reportage from the Cricketer magazine, from Wisden, from other places of cricket historically played in South America. So we knew that these places were there and cricket had been played at some point. What we weren't 100% sure about was that quite how far it'd be played in every single country. And that required an awful lot of sort of scouring on Facebook and Googling and just doing whatever you could. And that's the wonder of the internet, is that you can always find some evidence of this most of the time. So it did require a lot of digging, a lot of emailing, a lot of Facebooking, a lot of ringing up embassies in some cases. We did whatever we had to do to find these people and get in touch with them. And we almost always found that when we did find these people, they were delighted to meet us. And, you know, in some cases, a little bit flabbergasted. And, a couple of times we were asked if we were spies for the ICC, sent down to check on a sort of far-flung member that hadn't been visited for a while. But we weren't. That was part of the joy of it, really, was meeting these people. And actually, in a couple of cases, you know, what sticks in my mind is when we went to Costa Rica and there was a guy there called Daniel Spencer, who was 92, I think. And he'd played cricket in the 1930s and 40s, I think. And that was astonishing to just catch these people just in time. These old guys that have played decades and decades ago when these countries are completely different from how they are now in many cases.
There was, real brilliance in finding stories, oral histories, things that had never been written down, things we hadn't found in we'd searched the newspaper archives. We spent a week in Bolivia trawling through the newspapers, looking in La Paz in this windowless basement, looking for something, anything on cricket in Bolivia, and then we found something. It was a real thrill. But yeah, just recording those oral histories, as James said, places like Belize and Panama, maybe where not all the information was in Costa Rica, where the information wasn't written down, where some of the stories would have been lost had we not been fortunate to speak to people in the, you know, kind of 90s who remember George Headley coming to play in Panama or remember George Headley coaching as he did in Belize and remembered that history. So that was a real thrilling part of the book.
And of course, the section on Panama, birthplace of George Headley, as you revealed, I have no idea of that. The very moving story of his background and the fact that he started off playing baseball, not cricket. This great future, great one of the greatest batsmen the world's ever known.
I think he was in Panama until he was 10 years old. So I think he played in the street. He played on baseball diamonds that were around at that point. And actually, it surprised me that he didn't play cricket in Panama as a youngster, because there was cricket at that point and cricket was played. I suppose it was almost the tipping point for black Panamanians of West Indian background, where some were playing baseball and some were playing cricket and probably some were playing both. But so it did surprise me slightly that he hadn't played cricket in Panama, but he did play baseball. And that's partly where he learned his fielding techniques. And that's partly why he was so agile in the field. There were great, amazing stories of him sort of speaking Spanish under his breath. And when he was playing sport, and when he arrived in Jamaica, age 10 or whatever it was, he hadn't played cricket at all. He could, he didn't even have much English because he'd mixed with, Spanish speaking kids in the streets of Panama. And it was quite interesting reading up on that history, because a lot of people were saying that it was quite a segregated society in a lot of ways between white and black, between Spanish speakers and English speakers. And yet that was quite an encouraging thing that he had at least, he mixed with Spanish speaking kids in the streets playing sport. And I suppose that's one of the powers of sport.
It says something about life in the West Indies for black people that his family actually improved, that they endured terrible conditions in Panama, but they're nonetheless an improvement on what was available to them in Jamaica. And that was true of in Barbados as well, wasn't it? I mean, you know, the West Indian diaspora sort of emigrated to countries like Panama, worked under terrible conditions, but yet, you know, it was an improvement on what they could get as, say, sugar cutters or whatever.
I think certainly at some points in history that was true. You know, a staggering number of Barbadians went to Panama to work on the canal, and you know, that's again one of the. There was a great book which I recommend to all of you called Hell's Gorge, which was about by a guy I think called Matthew Parker, which is about the building of the Panama Canal, and that was brilliant in terms of the research, and it made you realise quite how many West Indians had gone to Panama to build that canal. Yeah, staggering. And even his one of the things that we uncovered in the archives, in the American archives, actually, was that George Headley's father had been, you know, where he'd worked on the canal, he'd got injured, all that sort of thing, which we discovered in the archives. And that was amazing to find that, because I don't think that's known at all. So and that's in the book. So that's something, you know, that was, again, a very rewarding but quite humbling thing to find that out.
Yeah, it was quite crazy in many ways. We obviously contacted the Headley family, contacted Ron Headley and Dean, and we kind of got to know them a little bit and talked to them. And
wonderful,
and we were
family,
kind of telling, wonderful. We were telling them almost in a way things they didn't know about their own father or grandfather, which was incredible about his background, about where the family, you know, where George originally grew up and what life he led in his early days. And obviously, James will tell you, I'm sure, that when George Headley actually went back there to play exhibition games in Panama, that maybe even helped his technique, James, in terms of the way he played cricket.
I think it's something that I thought of when I was looking into this, that there was an awful lot of games that were played that when it rained, obviously these being very tropical environments in a lot of cases in Latin America. I mean, obviously the landscape does change quite a lot depending on where you are, but. In Central America, if it rained a lot, one way of getting the game on, and this is something that I'm not sure English clubs would be allowed to do now, is that they would sort of sprinkle kerosene on the pitch and light it, and that would dry the pitch very quickly. Mm. And actually, and so, you know, you someone like George Headley would come back from a first class game and go on and sort of a boat trip to the Central America on the way to somewhere else, and he'd be playing on a burnt wicket against guys sending it down at, I assume, above 75 miles an hour. So. It may well be that he, you know, and he was noted for his excellence on wet wickets, even compared to Bradman. So it may well be that those experiences in Central America helped his brilliant technique on wet wickets.
I must say, the Headleys, I was thinking about the D'Oliveira family, you know, Louis, many generations, starting with Louis D'Oliveira, Basil's father, who was the captain of St. Augustine's and a superlative cricketer. Then, of course, Basil and Damien, and now... young B.L. D'Oliveira, who's having a reasonable season. And what you're seeing is the cascade down the generations. But also, you know, Basil had exactly those experiences on wickets in these really rotten wickets that, thanks to apartheid, had to play on. And that, I think, explains why he was such a superlative player of spin himself with that very short backlift. No, sorry. It just brings back my own experiences of doing this kind of research, where you're always discovering wonderful things.
Mm.
There's so many astonishing stories, individual stories within the book, including one which could be the plot of a John le Carré novel. What would you like to tell us about Philip Whitcomb, the teenage cricketer in English public school?
Yeah, this is a fantastic story, and I'll be honest with you, Richard. When we were writing the books, that chapter in Research in Colombia, we were a little bit thinking, oh, well, where's this chapter going to go? It feels a little bit the same as Chile. It feels a little bit the same as maybe some of the Central Americans. So we were really racking our brains as to what the strongest line was. And then just in the course of research, somebody mentioned to me that there's this guy who recently, I suppose the word is, he recently announced he was in fact the son of Pablo Escobar, the illegitimate son of Pablo Escobar, the notorious drug trafficker and Medellin cartel kingpin. So I thought, oh, this sounds, you know, quite interesting. Let's just find out, you know, this guy grew up in England. So I thought, oh, well, sounds wonderful. I wonder if he played, you know, my mind straight away thought, well, I wonder if this guy played cricket. So I Googled him and managed to eventually, after making a few phone calls and sending a few bit of correspondence, I managed to track him down. And he's an incredibly big personality, very interesting guy. And I said, oh, you know, I loved your story, fantastic story. Tell me, did you ever play cricket? And he said, would you believe I was at Luckton School in Herefordshire? And I was a wicket keeper. I was a terrible, terrible batsman. I used to try and slog it and you know, miss the ball all the time. But he was a wicket keeper, and he played for Luckton School all the way through. So he was off playing Malvern and various other schools all around. But the interesting thing was, because he was this son of Pablo Escobar, he was wanted quite back by Escobar himself. So he would often go to these away matches in the Midlands, and there'd be a black, sleek black Mercedes tailing the team bus just to make sure that the, you know, Pablo Escobar's henchmen weren't going to kidnap him in the middle of a game at you know, King's College in Worcester or something like that. So yeah, it's a fascinating tale. He's a very interesting guy. He didn't actually play any cricket in Colombia, but he was kind of ushered to the UK to stay away from, you know, getting into the clutches of the Medellin cartel. His father was a secret service agent involved with British operations overseas, and he was actually adopted, but he was by a British family, but he was born Roberto Sandoya Escobar. So yeah, the son of Pablo Escobar played cricket, which is quite a fascinating thing. But the Escobar connection with cricket doesn't actually end there. There was a you may remember back in I think the late 90s, early 2000s, a bank called BCCI, which was the acronym or the initialism was Banks of Crooks and Criminals International. And everyone from, I think, Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi and people like this all had their money locked away in BCCI. And BCCI actually also looked after the banking needs of Escobar. And the people who were looking after these needs in Bogota and in Medellin were actually a group of Indian cricketers. So they were Indian cricketers working for BCCI who actually managed the affairs of Pablo Escobar. So the Escobar connection, yeah, very, very interesting one. Perhaps people didn't necessarily put Escobar and cricket together, but there was a faint connection there.
Don't suppose that Philip Whitcomb's natural father turned up on Parents' Day. I don't imagine he ever watched his son play cricket.
I wouldn't imagine so. Perhaps maybe if he was, he'd have been in, you know, wearing the dark sunglasses and got a wig on or something and a bit of a disguise. Well, but I very much doubt it.
There might have been entry in the scorebook. Absent kidnapped, yes. Yeah. Let's move on a little bit. One thing that comes up really strongly in your book is how often in so many Latin American countries cricket actually has a head start over soccer and over the other popular sports in these countries. Cricket certainly has a head start over soccer in Brazil, Argentina, I think in Mexico, just about all the others, but it's overtaken quite quickly. What do you think is the underlying reason for that?
It's the million-dollar question. I mean, I think there's lots of theories that have been posited about that. I mean, one would be that it's not a contact sport, and that, you know, the contact sport of rugby and football sort of encourage people to sort of muck in together, as it were. I mean, I'm not 100% convinced about that. I think something that I would say that is absolutely crucial is the ease of playing other sports. You know, cricket relies on 22 yards of carefully tended earth, and in Argentina in particular they always insisted on playing on grass, and so really it needed people with a lot of money and a lot of wherewithal, especially with resources not necessarily there to produce the pitches to make those wickets, and that tended to be in members clubs. Now members clubs are still where cricket is played in Argentina and other parts of South America, and you know they are by their very nature slightly exclusive, and I think that probably played a part in cricket not becoming the sport of the proletariat, if you want to use that term. I'm convinced that that was part of it. I actually think, you know, especially looking at Argentina, I think there was a bit of a tipping point in, I would say, the interwar period, where cricket, if it was really going to catch on, it had to happen then. By the Second World War, I think it was, you know, in terms of becoming a mass popular sport, I think that was really the last chance, because, you know, the waning British influence around the world after that, I think it's really hard for it to come again until now, where India is so powerful. But I really think that they missed their chance up until about the 1930s, 40s. And after that, it became very, very difficult, because especially then a lot of governments changed. You had these very populist regimes came in, whether left wing or right wing. And, you know, I think Tim may have done his dissertation on this, but cricket, in my opinion, and Tim may disagree, doesn't tend to do particularly well in authoritarian regimes. It tends to do better in liberal democracies. Now, you may, having written a book on Pakistan, you may beg to differ. But
we did a little bit of research in Pakistan, which showed that Pakistan cricket does better under periods of democratic rule than under military rule.
There you go.
Their playing record is actually a little bit better. That takes us, doesn't it, to the Perron regime and the story that gives the title to your book. Timothy, would you like to tell us why did Evita burn down a pavilion?
Well, it's a fascinating story, and one that you know is the epicenter of the book in many ways, and probably sums up what, you know, the kind of the reasons behind that decline. What happened is Evita came on this glorious tour of Europe. She, you know, met Salazar and went to Paris and went to Madrid, and, you know, she was in contact with the British establishment about visiting Britain and meeting the Queen and having various junkets in Britain, and it kept being delayed. She said, "Okay, I'm going to come this week. I'm going to come the following week," and then eventually, I think the British establishment got a bit kind of fed up with Evita and kind of said, "Well, you know, you've kind of missed your chance to come and meet the royal family," and I think Evita probably saw a backside for that, or saw a, you know, it didn't go down particularly well with her. So she headed back to Argentina, and very unhappy with the impression she'd formed of British people and of the British attitude. And obviously the Brits had very much had a strong influence in the railways and in the meat factories in Argentina. And I think she was looking to de-escalate that influence, and the railways were nationalized and things were being brought back under Argentine control under her husband's presidency. And one of her ways of, you know, kind of getting into the British people in Argentina was to ask them for more money. So she asked them, the Buenos Aires Cricket Club, to give them more money for their for her social welfare fund. This didn't go down particularly well with the British members at the Buenos Aires Cricket Club, who said, "No, we're not giving you money towards your social welfare fund." And the reaction to that from Evita was to dispatch some baddies and some undesirables who were on the periphery of the Peronistas to torch down one of the gems in the British crown in Argentina, and to burn down the cricket pavilion. Nothing is more than a dagger to the heart of Brits living abroad than their cricket club, and to burn down the cricket pavilion, I think, was, you know, a real statement of intent of what she thought of British people and of cricket and British influence in Argentina.
Indeed. Evita was very fond of football, and she, or at least she tried to harness football, didn't she, to to the regime. I've seen a picture of Evita kicking off. That might have been the equivalent of the Argentine Cup final, wearing incredibly high heels. Must have found it very difficult to keep control of the ball. But football is very much the regime's choice of sport, and obviously cricket is, as you just said, is for these elite, snobbish, exploitative Britons who've, as you say, who've just snubbed her. And
on the other hand, the Argentinians seem to continue to like polo rather to excess, if you ask me. There was, of course, a wonderful Anglo cricketing history, wasn't there? I'm fascinated by the tour which the future Prime Minister, Alec Douglas Hume, who was a very mean cricketer, went with Gubby Allen in the early, and Plum Warner in the early 20s.
A brilliant tour, and actually very well reported on, I think probably because of Plum Warner's influences. He was the editor of The Cricketer at the time. And he'd just been kicked off the selection panel, the England selection panel, as it happens. And I think this may have been the sort of a sock to him. Go off with your mates down south and lead a cricket tour. But yeah, quite amusing. He met the Argentine president at the game at Hurlingham Club, which is also a polo club, famously on the outskirts of Buenos Aires. And he was mistaken for a bullfighter. The Argentine president thought he was a local bullfighter, which is quite amusing.
Alex was?
No, Plum Warner.
Plum Warner, yes.
And which is quite amusing because, as I learned recently from reading his granddaughter's piece in the 100th anniversary edition of The Cricketer, Plum Warner never ate anything. He ate about 2 peas for dinner, so he was very rakish. So how on earth he could have thought he was a bullfighter, I don't know. Anyway, it didn't go very well for Alec Douglas-Hume. He was Lord Dunglass at the time. So if you look at the scorecards of that tour, he's marked down as Lord Dunglass. And he had appendicitis. He was in bed for a week. It was terrible for him. He was ill at various games, and Warner shoved him in at short leg they didn't have helmets in those days. So no sympathy to the former, sorry, to the future British Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary at all. I don't think it was the happiest tour Alec Douglas-Hume ever did. But all told, it must have been an amazing experience. You know, they sailed down to Montevideo and Buenos Aires, and they sailed up the west coast of South America, stopping in Lima, going back through the Panama Canal. It must have been an incredible experience, even for these men who were the elite of British cricket and the elite of British society. It must have been an incredible experience. And, the reports are fairly staggering. There were, I think, 4 first class games played in Buenos Aires by MCC against Argentina. And Warner actually insisted on a 4th game being played after it was 1-1 after 3. So
that tells you, of course, is that there was very high standard of cricket.
Yeah,
they could, because that was a decent team, the Gubby Allen team. I mean, didn't it? I mean, it had Test players in it.
Absolutely. I think 4 or 5 Test players. I think Jack White, who was a very good left arm spinner from Somerset. And several others who were very good cricketers. But Argentina at the time. Probably that was the heyday of Argentine cricket, I would say. You know, an awful lot of people there working in ranches, in industry, in meatpacking, in utilities. And this was probably the apex of British influence in Argentina. So there were a lot of people there, a lot of Brits there who'd gone there. They were playing 6 months of the year in England and then going down to South America to play 6 months there in Argentina or Brazil or Chile or whatever. Very high standard. And I think only 5 or 6 years later, there was a first class tour of England by a South American team containing many of those same players and led by Clem Gibson, who had been a Wisden Cricketer of the Year when at Cambridge University. And really, it's so sad that the game did not at that point. And that's why I think that was almost a sliding doors moment for cricket in South America, because it's so sad that having produced such a high standard of players, it didn't seep down to enough people in the country.
James, there's one part of the book which really affected me personally, because I was at school with a wonderful person called Richard Smith Vaughan, as we knew him at Eagle House School in Berkshire in the 1960s. And he was, I played in the first 11 for the school with him, and he had very red hair. He was a wonderful, very, very warm and lovely person who came, we all knew, from Nicaragua. But you've placed him in the Nicaraguan context as a very fine cricket. Tell the story of what happened to Richard, because I'd love to know.
Well, he I think it was his grandfather initially, I've got a feeling, who moved. I think they were based in British Honduras, which was then Belize. And then they went across the jungle by mule to Nicaragua, and they started their own farm in Nicaragua, just south of Managua, I think. And they grew coffee, and they also had a lot of chickens as well. And they went on to produce a lot of the eggs for the country. Amazing sort of, I think they were Anglo-Jewish, I have a feeling. And the son of the initial settler, or the grandson, started cricket in and around Managua, and they went all over to play various other capital cities in Central America, in El Salvador, in Costa Rica, in Panama, all over really. and they played out the back of the British American Tobacco ground in Managua. And if anyone's been to Managua is listening to this, they'll know that it's at sea level and it's very hot, and it's punishing heat right at the lakeside level. And you can imagine how punishing that was playing cricket in those circumstances. I think they used to top dress the wicket with cast off tobacco, fertilizer. So it was quite an environment. But he was very much the fastest bowler in Nicaragua of his time, Ricardo Smith Vaughan that you knew.
Yeah, Richard. He was the opening bowler for the team I played for. He would and playing him in section matches, it was unpleasant. He was fast. Age 12, he was fast, and then he went on to, the fastest we ever played. We had it was a tremendous thing on our team to have him. And he went on to Wellington, I think, didn't he, Richard?
He did. Yeah. He did. And I think he was selected for England schoolboys, but couldn't go because he had to go back to the farm in Nicaragua to help out with the family. And that's a sort of common theme that runs through the book, that sort of thing happens. And in those days, it involved the boat journey rather than flying, certainly early on in his life. So, an amazing existence, going off to boarding school in England, but then coming home at other times of the year, all the way back to Nicaragua. But he retained his high skill in cricket. And there was a couple of fixtures, I think, against a team from San Jose in Costa Rica. And they had to ask the captain to ask Richard Smith Vaughan to slow down. Otherwise, the fixture couldn't carry on because he'd broken all their bats and various stunts and things. Cause he was so,
yes, that's the Richard Smith Vaughan I knew.
Yeah.
Very gentle man. Bright redhead he was in those days. And he was... Well, how did they cope with... You talk about the family. How did they cope with the Sandinistas, the Civil War?
Oh, well, we were lucky enough to meet his two brothers, Arturo and Tomas, and they were kind enough to invite us into the home that was and the farmhouse that was very much caught in the middle of the Sandinista war against the Somoza dictatorship in Nicaragua. In 1979, and it so happened that there was a band of Sandinistas and the Somoza forces managed to coalesce at this one point because they wanted this farmhouse because it was so strategically important in that part of Nicaragua, and it was about to get bombed, so this beautiful farmhouse that had been there since the late 19th century was about to be blown to smithereens, but at that very moment the US pulled the plug on their support of the Somoza dictatorship, which was a massive thing because, I think it was Roosevelt that had said he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. So if you'd excuse the language. It was I think the farmhouse was saved by that act by the USA. And so it did fall under Sandinista occupation, that farm, and then subsequently under the pro-Sandinista government. But they sort of managed to somehow, even though they were clearly capitalists, they managed to somehow find some sort of accommodation with the Sandinistas and work with the regime in the years to follow, which must have been quite interesting. But yeah, I have a feeling the Sandinistas managed to chop down the canopy, which provided all the shade for their coffee. So that didn't go down very well. But I think one of those things, they just had to accept it because they couldn't argue with the regime, really.
Yeah, one of the fortunate things about that farmhouse surviving was that all the cricket equipment, even though the Vaughans had to flee at the dead of night to take a flight to Miami, fortunately the cricket equipment in their farmhouse was safely locked away. And even though that this farmhouse was in the middle of the fighting, in the middle of the battle, the cricket equipment fortunately came out the other end unscathed, so that when the Vaughan family actually came back to Nicaragua, they were able to, a couple of years later, resume cricket again because that equipment kind of survived. And even when cricket made a kind of comeback again in 2000, I think in the early 2000s in Nicaragua, that very same equipment was what the players were using initially, because obviously the difficulties of, as a lot of countries in South America face, of just getting bats and balls and the rest of it and pads to the country, survived. So they were able to use that very, very same equipment that the Vaughans used all those years ago.
Wonderful.
It's funny, actually. Tim mentions the equipment factor, and that's been a massive problem going down the years. But in Brazil now, just in recent years, and Tim will be able to tell you the story, but they've started producing their own bats. in Brazil.
Yeah, it was a story. It was a story, funny enough, that emerged. Unfortunately for us, it emerged after we'd crossed the I's and dotted the T's on the book. But I managed to squeeze it into this year's Cricket Round the World. There's a chap called Luis Francisco in the spa town of Poços de Caldas, which is about 200 kilometres north of Sao Paulo. This guy, he's a retired engineer, and he's kind of turned himself into a bit of a carpenter. And the Brazilian Cricket Federation are growing the development program amongst Brazilian children at the moment. There's about 5,000 children in this town, Poços de Caldas, playing cricket. And they've expanded this program, or they're going to expand this program to about 30,000 people, which is 30,000 children, which is just incredible.
Glorious.
Wow. Absolutely incredible. But one of the problems they were facing is, where are we going to get all the equipment from? Where are we going to, you know, develop these kids playing cricket in Brazil in this town if we've not got enough bats? Mm. So this guy, Luis Roberto Francisco, has started making bats. Now, obviously, the willow tree is not native to Brazil. So he's had to been experimenting with other types of wood, I think with cedar wood and other types of wood. And he's absolutely adamant that out in the Amazon somewhere, deep in the Amazon rainforest, there must be a type of wood that's just as good as willow for cricket bats. Now, you may have seen a story recently saying bamboo. Exactly, bamboo. It could be better for cricket bats. But this guy, Luis, he's going to venture into the Amazon. I think he's tried with about 14 different varieties of wood so far. But he's adamant that somewhere in the Amazon, somewhere in Brazil, there's this other wood that's going to make the most fantastic cricket bats. So his cricket bats at the moment, he's rolled a few out, and the president of Cricket Brazil, a chap called Matt Featherston, who played a very good standard of club cricket in England, played a few games for Kent Cricket Board. He told me, he said, that the bats are, in my opinion, better than cashmere willow. They're good enough to take hard balls. We obviously want them to be even better so that we can use them in match use. So he's going to keep, you know, researching and making bats, and they're going to open their own bat factory in future. And the plan is to not only produce their own bats, but sell them to the rest of the world. So Gray Nichols, Newbury, you know, you better watch out. There's a new bat on the market, and it's made in Brazil.
Well, it's amazing. But a lot of...
Where the nuts come from, famously.
Well, yes, exactly.
But elsewhere in the book, you describe a lot of improvised bats and a lot of improvised balls made from local materials, don't you? Mm. Particularly, which reminded me very much of the invention of tape ball in Pakistan, where, as you know, somebody hit on the brilliant idea of covering a tennis ball in duct tape. But... you know, you describe balls made out of, I think, the nuts of fruit trees, and you know, with a bicycle tire wrapped around them, and a lot of bats made from local woods. So maybe this is a new growth industry right around the world.
And another thing is that the extent of railway, the British influence in the railways, is that in the late 19th century, early 20th century, there were actually forms of street cricket that were played by locals, using cast off bits of wood, playing in the street. And I think they saw the British playing cricket on their various grounds, and they made their own bats, and they came up with their own versions of the game. The one in Brazil is called taco, which I think actually means bat in Portuguese. So they've had their own forms of the game. And some of these have slipped out of use and come back again, but yeah, it shows that cricket must have had some cut through, but not enough to really send these people on to play the sort of the general standard that everyone else was playing. And funnily enough, when the ICC organised a street cricket festival in Trafalgar Square just before the World Cup final 2 years ago, Brazil came over and played taco. That was the game of street cricket that they came and played in that sort of exhibition tournament. Which was great. I actually saw a game of it. So there you go.
Yeah, I've just got to tell the full story of what you're referring to, Richard. It's a wonderful, wonderful story. The chap who told us this story, he lives. He was the development officer for a long time of cricket in Belize, and he was also his day job was looking after cricket in Belize, but he also was looking after a monkey sanctuary, the Howler Monkey Sanctuary out in Brazil. And he said he learned to play spin. He was known as a very good player of spin. And the way he learned to do it is he used to get a nut from, I think it was a super nut was the name. And that was wrapped in a bicycle tire, a bicycle inner tube. And he said when they bowled that, it made the ball deviate a lot more. So he said he became a very good player of spin from picking that nut wrapped in a bicycle inner tube. So yeah, wonderful, wonderful stuff.
Well, again that connects with Pakistan, because a lot of early spinners just practiced, and batsmen practiced, on absolutely anything that was sort of all sorts of improvised balls, and anything that could be made to spin, fruit, nuts, stones, whatever it was. Yeah.
I think you were lucky that Lord Ashcroft didn't refuse to tell you about cricket. I don't, it's a very bleak individual. I doubt you say that he loves cricket. I've never seen any evidence of that, I should say. But I mean, there are so many wonderful pieces of information that Simon Bolivar, the great liberator, was a fast bowler who knocked off the cap off the head of the future Ferdinand VII of Spain. I mean, it's just wonderful information. C.L.R. James explaining cricket to Leo Trotsky in exile. I mean, all of this, the kind of the richness of your book. I mean, there's a French garrison at Papillon prison playing cricket in the 1930s. I mean, this is reminiscent, of course, of what Clive Stafford Smith told us about cricket in Guantanamo, and was in the this year's Wisden. I mean, it's just so rich with glorious information. Tell us about Brian Johnson, though. I want to know about Brian Johnson's career as a wicketkeeper.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. Brian Johnston was, before he became the kind of national treasure and legend of BBC broadcasting, the Johnston family were actually very, very heavily involved in coffee. And as part of his, after he left Eton and after he left university, Brian was sent off to work in the family coffee plant in Santos in Brazil, which is a port probably we know a little bit more of. Pelé obviously played for Santos, but before that, Brian Johnston was there running the coffee empire. But he admitted himself he didn't want to leave London, he didn't want to leave all his friends behind, and he didn't want to leave cricket behind. He very much didn't want to go there, and he admitted himself he knew nothing about coffee. He couldn't tell one bean from another, but he was still, you know, the family representative in Santos. But he was fortunate that afforded him the opportunity to play in one of South America's most prestigious matches. It's the state of Sao Paulo versus the state of Rio de Janeiro. So Brian Johnston kept wicket for the state of Sao Paulo. He was a fine. He got some wonderful stories from his son Barry on the cricket that he played there. And there's actually in the plate section of the book, there's a lovely picture of Johnners with his, I think it's maybe his Isengari or his Free Foresters jazz hat on in the 11 for Santos Athletic Cricket Club. He's very well. He's still remembered there. The family is, when we visited Santos, we met some of the, you know, older members, and they remember the Johnston family living there and the Johnston family legacy. His character very much shone through. He kind of shunned the local food a little bit. He wasn't particularly keen on eating the abundance of fresh fruit and vegetables that were on offer. Maybe perhaps typical of British people at the time, not necessarily open to foreign cuisine. But he joined in the Rio, you know, he joined in the carnival time in both Rio and in Sao Paulo. He had a thrilling time doing that. But unfortunately, after I think 2.5 years there, he was struck down with beriberi. He became very ill, and he could kind of barely move. So his mother sailed out from the UK to Britain to see him again and help nurse him back to health. And then he sailed from Santos back to Britain, and his kind of adventure in Brazil was over. But he seemed to, you know, from reading his own, the correspondence that Barry showed me and the information we got, you know, he enjoyed his time there. He threw himself into very much into life.
From the a more melancholy subject, you reveal that the Pinochet family were keen cricketers. General, tell us about General Pinochet, the cricketer.
Yeah, that was. It's actually there was rumours that Pinochet was played the game, but we referred to it as only being rumours because we couldn't stand it up. We couldn't actually find the proof that was the case. But it was very the location of the Prince of Wales Cricket Club, or rather the Prince of Wales Country Club. Is actually very, very near the military school where Pinochet was educated and gained his military credentials. So there was rumours that he used to drift across and play games occasionally, or he was invited to play games at the Prince of Wales Country Club. But we could find no evidence. We found nothing on a scorecard. But what we did find was that his grandchildren were very keen cricketers. They both went to one of the British schools there, and the Chile cricket Chile were very much, you know, embedded with the schools there. So yeah, two of Pinochet's grandchildren both played cricket. Interestingly enough, they were actually denied entry to, or rather, they were prevented from travelling, I should say, to represent Chile and Argentina. Because the family were being investigated for, I think, financial irregularities or something along those lines. So the two Pinochet grandsons weren't allowed to travel and represent Chile and Argentina.
I'm fascinated by two earlier cricket lovers in history. Latin America's two emperors. Pedro II loved cricket, according to your book. And what I hadn't realised was that poor Emperor Maximilian of Mexico actually seems to have played cricket. He produced a wonderful photograph of him in his whites. Tell us about Maximilian particularly. Do you know what the score was in his match? do you know if he made any runs or took any wickets?
Yeah, it's a fascinating story that the upper echelons of not just British society but other countries as well. So the Austro-Habsburg Empire, as you said, Emperor Maximilian was became good friends with a lot of the British establishment there, and perhaps a game of cricket during his brief time as during the monarchy of Mexico probably provided a bit of respite for him amongst the daily travails. Unfortunately, though, that not many scorecards have survived from that time, but there is actually a magnificent photo which we've included in the book, which is actually hanging, funny enough, in the Royal Brussels Armoury Museum, and it's actually a picture of the oldest sporting photograph in Mexico in it, and there with all the traditional boater hats and kind of uniforms of the day, and everyone's in a very kind of straight upright pose or lying down, or the very typical photos of the era. And in amongst them is Emperor Maximilian, who was very much a keen cricketer, and, before he was shot by firing squad. So I think 2 years before they took a photo of him. Oh, it's the same photographer. Yeah, same French photographer took a photo of him playing cricket and then, sketched the picture of him being shot by firing squad. So, interesting.
Celebrated picture by Manet, but Manet never did Emperor Maximilian playing cricket.
I mean, the one thing about Mexico is that extraordinary for the modern visitor is you go up to Chapultepec Castle and you look out over this vast sprawling city, I think the biggest in the world, and yet going back to that time, the ground that they played at was not far at all from the palace. And so, they would look down from the castle and there was the cricket ground and there was the beautiful meadow where the English played cricket, and not just the English, but a few Mexicans as well. That was something that we came across time and time again, is that you'd get these lovely old cricket clubs that had been based in the centre of these cities, very close to the centre of power, and yet as the cities had expanded over time and all these high-rise buildings go up and these cities just mushroom, the cricket grounds get swallowed up and clubs move further and further out of the cities as days go on, until they're playing 2 hours out of the city. So that was something that we were sort of encountered time and time again.
I remember I lived in Mexico when I was a little boy, from 3 to 6, and can't remember any cricket, but I can remember Mexico City. Perhaps it was because we lived in a very, very good district, the San Angel district, and actually Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo were the next-door neighbours. I do remember Mexico City as being... I couldn't resist dragging that in. I do remember Mexico City as being very green as a child and beautifully clear air. Amazingly, amazing to think of that now.
Well, one of the fascinating stories, Richard, with Mexico City that this is one scorecard we did unearth in Mexico City, was when England's footballers turned up. They were training and basing themselves at the Reforma Athletic Club, which is the kind of bastion of Britishness and the bastion of the cricket there for a long time. So, and when England's footballers pitched up, you know, something that's unimaginable now, they were challenged to a game of cricket by the Reforma Athletic Club, by the Mexico City Cricket Club that was based at Reforma. So Gary Lineker and John Barnes and, you know, all the rest of them strapped on the pads and played a game of cricket against Reforma. And it happened previously as well in the previous World Cup. There was it in 1970. In 1970, when the previous England football team under Alf Ramsey went there with Jeff Hurst, who of course made a few first class appearances for Essex, they also challenged the Mexico City Cricket Club to a game. So it led to some, you know, interesting games taking place in far flung places wherever the British were.
So many riveting bits of history that you've uncovered. Simon Bolivar, the cricketer, knocking off the cap of the future king, that really symbolises the whole independence struggle in Latin America, doesn't it? Knocking off that future king was the king who lost Spain's colonies, wasn't he? Ferdinand VII.
Well, yeah, again, another absolutely incredible story. You know, you're unearthing gems of history that have been lost to time. And that is one where it was actually when Bolivar was very, very young. He was in Spain studying and the reference to cricket was nothing more than that he knocked off the cap of Ferdinand. So, yeah, it was a funny little story. But I guess Bolivar maybe mixed with a lot of Irish and British people who went to join the wars of independence in that part of South America. So he probably would often fraternise with characters, you know, people like Lord Cochrane, who also had a cricketing connection in Chile around is known to umpire games there. So there is these fascinating tales of people you perhaps don't associate having a connection to cricket, such as Simón Bolívar, the great liberator. And yeah, he played the game at one point in his life and mixed with a lot of the Brits and the Irish who ultimately bequeathed the game to other parts of the continent for the very first time.
Of course, a lot of those Brits and the Irish, they fought with him as he in his wars. The timing is not at all accidental of the liberation of Latin America, because it happened after 1815. We wanted the Spanish on our side when we were fighting Napoleon, and only once we knocked over Napoleon at Waterloo did Bolivar and the Brits and a lot of ex-Waterloo veterans and Peninsular War veterans were part of, I think I'm right in saying, of the armies, which they probably brought a bit of cricket with them as they fought their way through Latin America.
Bolivar must have knocked off the young prince's cap with underarm bowling.
That's a very good point.
I guess it would have been.
Well, maybe it's simply a myth. Yes, that's actually, you suddenly made me worry about that story.
underarm bowling is quite, could be very severe on a rough pitch. I can't remember the exact details, but a chap fielding was killed by an underarm delivery. Never mind a batsman. Wow.
Well, so, Frederick, Prince of Wales, was killed by a cricket ball, was he not? In 1751, I think I'm right.
Yes, yeah. Most celebrated victim, yeah.
Funny you mentioned the Prince of Wales there, Peter, because he actually played at the current Prince of Wales, played a game in Panama. Wasn't much of a cricketer by all accounts, but he was... Right. He was working as a communications officer, I think. Is that right, James? Do you want to tell this story, James? It's your part.
I got a feeling that this is just after Camilla had become engaged to Andrew Parker Bowles, and Charles had gone off for his military training, and they'd gone back. They were going back through the Panama Canal, I think, on the way to Bermuda, I think, And yeah, he was, and the local West Indian club managed to get wind of the fact Charles was around, and they challenged them to a game in a wonderful place called Paraíso, which is an old dredging village on the Panama Canal. And we were lucky enough to meet a guy called Mickey Thompson, who played in that game. He's from Trinidad originally, and he played for that West Indian side against Prince of Wales, and he wasn't that impressed by the Prince of Wales's cricket. But his father, the late Duke of Edinburgh, he actually came very close to playing a game in Costa Rica, but he had some official engagements he had to do, so he wasn't able to play in that match. And that would have been in San Jose, I think, a few years later. But yeah, unfortunately,
he would have been furious.
He did it. Yes. He actually did like cricket. Yeah. So yeah,
Going down the generations, and you say in the book, Prince Harry played a game of street cricket in Brazil without great success, I believe.
No, yeah, I mean the photo we carry in the book, he looks like he's about to get stumped, because under the rules of TACO, if you don't ground your bat after the ball misses your bat, you have to ground it back in the crease. And under those rules, I think he was going to get stumped, I think. So yeah, not the most glittering example.
Tell us, I mean, this great conversation between CLR James, of course, was a Trotskyite, explaining to the man himself before he was axed in the head by one of Stalin's emissaries about the game of cricket. What did you find out about that?
Yeah, this was a fascinating little nugget that actually we couldn't find a place for it in the Mexico chapter. It didn't really seem to fit the narrative of the Mexico chapter. So we ended up just dropping it into the introduction, just to give a flavour of the breadth of influence that and the strange places that cricket would touch. So yes, CLR James was visiting Mexico City. He was actually in the US around the time of the civil rights movement, and came down to the US to exchange ideas with Trotsky on Marxism and various conversations. Trotsky at that time was conducting an affair with Frida Kahlo in the house of Diego Rivera. So a fascinating dinner time chat that must have been with CLR and Trotsky and Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera, the painter, all sat around the dinner table. And of course, CLR just couldn't resist asking Trotsky what he thought of cricket. So I'm not quite sure quite what Trotsky's response was. I think he was probably a little bit bemused by his opinions on it. But I think CLR James was taking a break at that time from his job at the Manchester Guardian. And I don't think he actually squeezed a game in Mexico, but I know he very much kept up with what was going on. There was, count various reports carried over the telegrams.
These were CLR James's lost years, of course, when he went off to try and create a revolution in the United States, a forlorn objective. And think of all that wonderful cricket writing the world lost as a result of this misconceived notion that he could bring Trotsky's ideas to New York.
Yeah, they very much were his lost years. As I said, I think he did kind of keep in touch with cricket, even though he was in the midst of all that. He still followed the county championship. But
I know he did. I still mourn though this waste of time of CLR, the greatest. What's he doing in New York, really? What's he doing?
Most celebrated Marxist cricketer was H.M. Hindman, this Marx's British disciple, who said he became a Marxist and a revolutionary because he didn't get a cricket blue at Cambridge.
He was late 19th century, wasn't he? Played for Sussex,
yeah.
Richard.
Yeah, he was so disappointed that he turned to, he turned to the became a revolutionary.
Well, on that subject, we did, again, we were hopeful. But unfortunately, this was another kind of dead end. But Che Guevara, unfortunately, we couldn't quite track down anything that suggested he may have well been exposed to the game in Argentina. He lived in the San Isidro district and briefly in was it Rosario and Cordoba. But he played rugby famously in Buenos Aires. But we found a few inklings that maybe he was subjected to the game, but he didn't actually. We couldn't find a scorecard with Ernesto E.C. Guevara on, unfortunately.
Yes. Probably been a professional. Guevara EC probably have his initials on. probably have his initials afterwards, wouldn't he? Yeah. He's not an amateur toff, you know, so he'd be, yes. Guevara EC, yes. I was really interested to read all the accounts of cricket projects in different Latin American countries for children and young people who've experienced violence. And going back to something James said earlier about why cricket may not have caught on in South America, lack of physical contact in the sport, a lot of these projects say it's particularly good in rehabilitating children of victims of violence precisely because there isn't direct physical contact between players. And another factor they mention is that cricket is new, completely new to so many of these children and young people, and it has no memories for them, it has no painful memories for them, and they have the satisfaction of learning a new skill. Now, those are things that was said to us some months ago by Richard Verity in the Alsama Cricket Project in the Shatila camp in Shatila in Beirut. And I just wonder if it's a phenomenon that one could see all over the world, that one might export all over the world. Cricket as an antidote to violence.
Well, I think there may well be some truth in that. I mean, I think football, for all its power and all its accessibility, it can be quite adversarial. It can be quite tribal. I think that was certainly the impression we got in Guatemala. I think that's probably the bit you're referring to when it's a religious school that's been set up by two evangelicals who came over from Hampshire and they introduced cricket to their congregation. To the boys that were mainly boys, but also girls that were in their school. And when they tried football, a lot of the time it ended up in violence and fighting and people being run off the pitch. And even, and there's quite a big split in Guatemala between people who are sort of mixed race and people who are indigenous, seen as indigenous Mayans, they're known as there. And whereas cricket didn't really have the same effect in some way, you know, especially because they were learning how to play a new game. They were learning how to spin the ball. They were learning how to bat in the way that you need to face the ball that bounces. And so, you know, they were enjoying learning a new game without the sort of baggage of slight, of the slight rough and tumble of football, and also the slightly adversarial nature of different teams that you're associated with. So I think there may well be some truth in that. It's something that we also encounter to degrees elsewhere. I think in Santiago as well, in Chile and in Brazil to a degree. So from being a sport that was very much spread through the members clubs that may have been played in elite schools going down the years, there are people now across the continent trying to bring cricket to communities that don't have much, you know. And in Guatemala, a lot of those boys had been on the verge of falling into gangs and violence. So it's almost like going back to the old days of the Christian missionary trying to spread cricket to different parts of the world. So not everyone will be happy with that, but I think cricket does have some sort of role and some sort of power in that regard.
It has been an absolutely wonderful conversation. Your book is, I can't say how much I admire it or envy you the great journey which has created it. It's a masterpiece. It's going to be read in 100 years' time. You've recorded things which would never have been recorded, but for your wonderful work. I just want to thank you on behalf of cricket lovers for going out and staying in all of those backpacking and staying in all of those cheap places and meeting such rich and memorable people.
Very kind. Humbling, Peter. Thank you. That's very kind. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. The hairs on the back of my neck stood on end then, Peter, when you said that. Thank you very much.
Well, I'd like to echo that. Timothy and James, it's been an absolute treat talking to you. It's been a treat reading your book in preparation for it. Perhaps you'll have a second or third innings, but for now it has to be goodbye from me. Richard Heller, sunnier still, South East London.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Oborne, in East Wiltshire.